world tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Don't you get sick of hearing some of these tragic assaults on the elderly by young thugs that roam the streets of our cities today? From Miami Beach, Florida, came this report. Sarah Kirsch, 70, had moved to Miami Beach recently to escape crime in New York City. Sarah is dead now, apparently choked slowly by a cloth gag placed in her mouth by armed robbers, angered because she only had 3 cents to give them. Police were looking for two robbers, and an elderly friend had recalled that 70-minute reign of terror that led to Sarah Kirsch's death. She said, "I was sick and my two friends came to keep me company." This was Esther Josephson, 77, in Miami Beach. The women who came over that night were Mrs. Kirsch and Adelaide Slaus, 81. A knock came on the door. They thought it was another lady, so Mrs. Kirsch went to open it, and here were two young men with guns and a knife, pushed their way in and tied up all three of the women, told them not to make a sound, they wouldn't get hurt, and proceeded to try to rifle the entire place. They took $40, the one elderly lady had. Mrs. Slaus gave them another $85. The other lady only had 3 cents, so they said, "We'll fix you for that." She was guilty because she was in poverty, on welfare. "We'll fix you for that," they said, and for that they hit Mrs. Kirsch, age 70, these teenage young thugs with strong young bodies, over the head. They hit Mrs. Slaus, too, who had given them $85, and she kept crying, "Oh, please stop." But poor Mrs. Kirsch, you see, was crying because they twisted her around as they tied her up, and she had already fallen earlier and had a broken hip and had to have a pin placed in it. And because she was crying, they said they would shut her up, so they gagged her, tied her, and taped her with a cord, and dragged them around the house. Mrs. Josephson said, then they had to lie there and watch Mrs. Kirsch die. She said, "I will never forget the sight of her there. They cut my phone wire, tore up the apartment, took everything, small jewelry, small safe box, my checkbook, my medicines. Then they sat down and took some soft drinks out of my refrigerator and drank them. They were in there for 1 hour and 10 minutes. I kept praying, please God, let them get out." Hours after the men finally left, a neighbor heard the victim's cries and opened Mrs. Josephson's door to find the three ladies there. But Mrs. Kirsch had slowly strangled to death on that cloth gag. Now, of course, if those young men are caught, and the chances are very, very poor that they will be, they very likely could be out on the street within minutes of their arrest, according to our recidivism, which is recycling of criminals, or revolving door justice that we have because of plea bargaining, weak laws, very, very strange approaches that we have to capital punishment, or punishment which is exactly suitable to the crime in this country of ours. In deterring the slaughter of Americans, we are not willing to utilize the most powerful possible deterrent we could have, which is the exact, swift, consistent punishment commensurate with, consistent with, the degree of the criminal act. We don't have the faintest concept of what that kind of a law would do inside the United States. You know, back in Exodus, the 21st chapter, one of the greatest laws that had ever been given to a human race of people was illustrated, was listed, was pointed out to the leaders of Israel. That law was so righteous, so holy. Yes, the law that was called the Old Covenant, the Old Testament law, the law of the book of the law, the law that had to do with the administration of a system of justice in the ancient nation of Israel, that was eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. Do you know that the Bible says that law was so righteous that Moses' face shone when he came down from the mountain? God's word said that law was so great that if the people would live within it, they would ride the high places of the earth. They would be the greatest nation on earth, the greatest productivity, the greatest cornucopia, the outpouring and outflowing of all the wealth, the produce of all of the world to all other races, all other nations. They would really be riding the high places of the earth if they would follow that law. Let's see, as we look at the case of poor Mrs. Kirsch, who moved away from New York City because she was scared of crime and ended up in that apartment in Miami Beach, strangling to death because the robbers, young teenagers, wanted to punish her for having dared to show up at the scene of their crime with only 3 cents. It says in Exodus 21, talking about a man fighting and hurting a woman who is pregnant so that she loses the baby, that you were to give, in verse 23, life for life. Now that's a strange concept. That a life is taken, it costs a life. But we say in the United States that is cruel and unusual and inhuman. We don't dare do that. And a lot of people have the absolutely hideous and obscene notion that criminals have a death wish. That criminals who kill people aren't afraid to die. Is that true? No, it is not. It's a stupid sob sister excuse. You may not have read recently about the cheering, the applauding, the absolute celebration by those criminals on death row in a California prison when a California Supreme Court, a state Supreme Court, struck down the will of the people of the state of California by ruling unconstitutional the death penalty statute, which the voters of the people of California had gone to the polls to put in. The people wandering the streets of San Francisco and Los Angeles who have been victimized by the Zodiac or the Slasher, the people who are being indiscriminately beaten, bludgeoned, choked, raped, kicked, strangled, shot, and stabbed, and their relatives, went to the polls to try to put in capital punishment as a deterrent to crime, and the California State Supreme Court struck down the will of the people. It's no wonder people don't want to go to the polls to vote. It's no wonder a lot of people figure, what's the use to vote? Nothing ever happens anyway, and nothing is going to get done. But if this slobbering sob-sister excuse that quavering criminals who commit crimes that end up in murder are themselves possessed of a death wish has any value to it whatsoever, then I'd like to ask, why were all those on death row so happy that pandemonium broke out, according to San Quentin prison officials, when the news reached the condemned men on death row? According to Sergeant Jack Riley of that institution, they're up there, he said, cheering and yelling. They're in a very festive kind of mood. He said if they had champagne, they'd be drinking it. Then we come up with a study from an official in the criminal justice system who says, and I quote, if there is one thing the vast majority of killers, rapists, kidnappers, thieves, robbers, and muggers fear most, it is being killed. They don't want to die. Interesting, isn't it? You know, in 1972, the United States Supreme Court struck down the death penalty not because it was unconstitutional, but because it was being unequally and unfairly applied by the various states. Isn't that a strange way to reason? Here is a law, and people are not applying that law correctly. They are not administering that law correctly. They are abusing that law. So what you do is, because people don't know how to properly apply the law, strike the law from the records. That gets rid of the problem. That makes about as much sense to me as here I am flying along in a jet airplane. And I get a warning horn that says my engine is on fire. Now, when I see that red light and hear that horn, I'm supposed to instantly cut off the fuel to that engine, shut down the throttle, close off a bleed air valve, make sure the airframe and engine anti-ice is off, and a few other little items there and a checklist. But no, I decide I got a problem here. The engine's on fire. So what I do is reach for a little ball-peen hammer and put out the master fault warning light and silence the dumb horn, because it's giving me a problem. The United States Supreme Court struck down the death penalty back in 1972, not because it was unconstitutional, but because it was being unequally and unfairly applied by the various states. Can you believe that? Well, it's true. That's exactly why they did it. In April of 1976, when the U.S. Supreme Court was going through another marathon hearing on the constitutionality of capital punishment, Justice Lewis F. Powell, whom I applaud, startled courtroom proceedings by quoting some Federal Bureau of Investigation statistics that proved there had been a 50% rise in the rates of homicides in a 5-year period. He said, and I quote, it is perfectly obvious from these figures that we need some way to deter the slaughter of Americans. I use that term because that was the term that was used to describe the Vietnam War. And more Americans have been killed in the streets of this country than were killed on the battlefields of Vietnam. They claimed that courtroom spectators at that particular session were stunned because it was almost unheard of for any justice to indicate in advance, and very boldly so, exactly how he intended to vote on some issue. And at that same proceeding, Justice Harry A. Blackmun also chided attorneys, attacking capital punishment, for ignoring the innocent victims of the murderers whose death sentences were then under review. Now, I told you recently in a program that every baby born since 1974 has a greater chance of being the victim of a murder in the streets of America's cities and towns than did the average American GI wearing olive drab in World War II, meeting his death on a battlefield. Calculations by an operations research team at MIT indicate that if murder rates stay right where they are and don't even go any higher, which is a really stupid and very over-optimistic assumption, that any person born in a large American city these days continuing to live there has more chance of being murdered than an American soldier did in World War II, dying in combat. But you know, when you ask people, why not just lock these people up? Why not do like New Orleans did and get them off the streets? Well, they didn't get them all off the streets, but at least there was one report in New Orleans that gave you a little bit of hope when you realized that violent crime rates were falling in sharp contrast to a lot of the rest of the nation. They said the reason, which came from the district attorney's office, was that many New Orleans career criminals have been in prison. It was said by the DA there that when you get these people off the streets, the crime rate drops, and they've proved it. Mandatory prison terms, longer sentences, and a reduction in plea bargaining all contributed to that decrease in crime down there, according to officials. And overall, the serious crime rate had dropped a little bit. Not a lot, but a little bit, about 2%. Murders fell 22%. The number of forcible rapes, aggravated assaults, and burglaries decreased a little bit. There were 230 fewer armed robberies out of the thousands. The only category that increased was larceny theft, and included, of course, things like shoplifting, which might not affect the hardened criminal so much as it does boys, girls, Mr. and Mrs. Housewife, Mr. Average American, who is a ripoff anyway. I mean, when you see the police had to go down after the big blast in the San Pedro and Long Beach Harbor area, because immediately when a lot of the local citizenry found the shop windows and the store windows blasted out where the glass was gone, they started helping themselves to the objects in the store windows, so the police had to go in to prevent looting. But that's another aside. That's just your average American going about his daily way of living. The result, predictably, in New Orleans was packed prisons. Now, that's bad, and when you ask the question of many of these do-gooders, slobbering sob sisters, and other people, including some quavering lawyers who want to keep these crooks out of jail, they will say, why, prisons are full of violence. Isn't that tough? Here is a violent thug who kicked a little elderly lady to the ground and choked her half to death, but you don't want to send that jackass to a place where it's violent. Send him to a Peoria pink tea party where a pusillanimous pansy is perusing the course of petunia patches in the summer or something. The idiot can't be sent to jail because it's violent in there. Mercy sakes alive, you can't put that guy where there's violence. The prisons are full of violence, they say. There's corruption in prisons. There is perversion there. There's homosexuality there. But, you know, there are other crooks there, too. The only difference is, I've talked to a lot of these prisoners. You know, they tell me that sometimes there's an awful lot of hatred in prisons, and that sometimes these dirty thugs get themselves enemies. Well, you know, it's just one little comment I'd like to make. At least inside those prisons are running to Mrs. Kirsch's age 70 with 3 cents in her purse. If those guys want some violence, they can find it in the form of one of these plastic pencils jammed all the way up their nose into their brain. Because that's exactly the way some of them die. But the only difference is, inside the prisons, the crooks are attacking each other, and not innocent, helpless, elderly ladies on the streets of our cities and towns. I don't buy the reason why people don't lock up prisoners is because prisons are full of violence, corruption, perversion, and homosexuality. It's no doubt that's what they're full of, because that's the kind of people they put there. What in the world do you expect them to be full of? Pink tea parties? A number of years ago, a judge said, "What's wrong with our system of punishment?" Well, he said, "What's wrong is it doesn't work. It protects society inadequately, and it seldom reforms criminals." My answer today is, so what? At least it protects society from them. It proved to do pretty well in New Orleans, where even though they had jammed prisons and about 500 waiting to go to jail, Wessel, who was one of the leading assistant district attorneys there, said career criminals were moving out of that town. They'd gotten the word. Now let's take a look at this law that ancient Israel had, which says in verse 23 of chapter 21, "You shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe." And let's assume that down in Miami Beach they had caught that young thug who brutalized Mrs. Kirsch. Do you know what that law in the book of Exodus would have required would be done to that young man? First, he would be bound with tape and a light cord. Then, he would be struck over the head with a heavy object, maybe the butt of a gun, pistol whipped about the face a little bit, twisted in a very uncomfortable position down to the ground, and then dragged from room to room. Then he would have had a cloth gag stuck in his mouth and tied very tightly, and would have been allowed to lie there and choke to death on it. That's right. They would kill that rotten, filthy thug in precisely the manner, the shape, and the routine that he inflicted death upon this poor elderly. They might have even gone to the point of taking all his money and leave him 3 cents in his pocket and take that away from him before he died. I don't know. But if they're going to administer justice eye for eye and tooth for tooth and hand for hand, that's exactly what they would do. They'd kill him in exactly the same way he killed her. And as he was dying, he too would probably be screaming out to the person hitting him on the head, "Oh, please, don't hit me anymore." But isn't that brutal of me? Isn't that terrible? I can just hear the sobs, the wails, and the crying out there somewhere, where the slobbering sob sisters really just bleed. Their poor bleeding hearts just drop huge, great, big, bloody, salty tears of human blood and crying and so on over the murderers and the killers. They don't seem to care about the victims. You know, there was a TV network, I believe an interviewer anyway, he went into one of the large southern prisons here recently, and you saw the cameras and the lights following, and his voice fairly dripping with sarcasm about the terrible conditions in his overcrowded jail. Just awful. You don't want a criminal to live in a place that's overcrowded. He's got to live in a place where he's got lots of room. He doesn't want to live in a place like, for instance, a four-story walk-up slum apartment someplace in the South Bronx, the way an awful lot of other people have to live in fear of the crimes that he's perpetrating. Criminals shouldn't be in places where it's violent, where it's crowded, where there is perversion or homosexuality or corruption. They ought to be in beautiful, cheerful, brightly lit, spacious, airy 20th century apartments with all of the amenities and commodities, and with television sets and thick carpets and lovely overstuffed sofas and leather chairs and lots of reading material, you know, and visits from the family, and like this furlough system, for example, where I told you in a program recently, at least one state official, I believe a state senator up in one of the northeastern states, had decided it was getting pretty hard to be a liberal anymore because he'd voted for the furlough system. That was where a criminal who had been in jail or prison could go home for a weekend. Wasn't that cute? Real cute law there. Only way he came to find out that one of these that went home on a weekend killed somebody. But also he found out that his own wallet was lifted in the state capitol parking lot by a thug with a gun who was out on a furlough. And then he also found out about a week later his automobile was stolen from the same parking lot. And he was going in there to that state building to vote for the prison furlough system. He changed his mind. He said it was getting harder and harder to be liberal with all this going on. That was interesting. I remember a New York cabbie that was kind of talking through a shrunken mouth. He was sort of lisping a little bit. And he was telling why he walked around and drove around the city with just his gums. He was telling us, we were riding in his cab out to the airport, why he left his bridge work at home. Because he said last time he was robbed, he'd been robbed many, many times. That's why they have on the sides of the cabs now all over the United States and all of our big cities, practically all of them, I think all. Warning, driver carries no more than $5 in change. That's why they've had to re-equip the cabs with little safes in them, which are actually welded to and anchored to the frame of the vehicle with a place where the man can drop the money in and he doesn't have the key or the combination. If the thugs want to get at the safe, they're going to have to try to blow it themselves and get the petty cash they can find out of a yellow cab, and that doesn't really prove to be worth it very much. Cabs in the United States ought to look like the old cabriolets of way back, but they ought to look like modern-day police cars with very heavy steel mesh, so that the people who get in the cab can ride inside a cage and the driver himself can ride in a separate cage protected from these thugs who like to prey on innocent cab drivers by hitting them over the head from behind. But this poor guy had left his bridge work at home because he said the last time his face was all cut and his nose bleeding and his lips shattered and so on because this dirty thug took a blackjack or a piece of lead pipe or something and hit him right across the mouth. And of course he had whatever it was, $1,000 or so invested in his bridge work. And that shattered his bridge work. And so when he went to get all his damage repaired, had to go to the hospital, had to get a new set of bridge work. The only time he wore it anymore was when he went out with friends or was safely at home. He didn't wear it on the job. He just went around whistling and lisping and gumming a leering red grin at people because he was afraid to wear his teeth. Now, if they could catch that crook, you're right, I'm coming to it. We're back to Exodus again. What they would do is take him to a place where a lot of people can see it, television cameras ready, lights, action, camera. And here's this idiot standing there with a nice set of natural teeth and standing alongside the little cab driver with his bridge work all smashed and shattered in his hands, and his lips are bloody and bleeding because they caught the crook right away, we assume. And so the cab driver is given a big lead pipe, and he strolls up to this strong young thug, and with one great big roundhouse swing, knocks every tooth out of the filthy thug's head. End of story. Okay, thug, you can go now. That's it. Oh, by the way, you got to give the money back. Oh, and by the way, there's something more. You have to restore that money 5 times over. I forgot that part. Let's go to that. That's in the Bible, too. Did you know that? It says, for example, in the 22nd chapter of the book of Exodus, that a person is to restore even more than they stole. In some cases, they're to restore up to 5 times over. They pay double, and so on. If a man steals an ox or a sheep, it says, and kills it or sells it, he is to restore 5 oxen for 1 ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. Let's apply that to an automobile. A man steals a car, and he sells it or he wrecks it. Then he is going to give the owner of that vehicle 5 automobiles. And he's going to have to work to produce that. And his sentence is not served until that has been produced. It says here in verse 2 of chapter 22, if a thief be found breaking up, all right, that's breaking and entering, or burglary, and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. How about that kind of a law to protect homeowners? Now, we got it the other way around. You know that, don't you? In California, now here's what you've got to do in the state of California. I don't know about you people in New York, Detroit, Houston, Chicago, some of the other big cities where crime is so very, very high, Dallas, etc. But out here, homeowners are not necessarily encouraged to own a gun, though many do. And the reason they are not is because if they should shoot a burglar as he is ripping off their apartment, they can go to jail. Now, probably in their case, they would. I don't know. I assume that if you kill a burglar, you're probably going to suffer the death penalty. I guess when you kill an innocent victim age 77 or so, you don't. But anyway, the law seems to read that you are going to pay the uttermost farthing if you dare to shoot one of these poor burglars. Well, all in the world he's trying to do is to take your color television set to feed his $175-a-day heroin habit. But at any rate, he's there, you got the gun, don't shoot him in the living room. Because you can't prove, if you're in the living room and his body's in the living room, that you had opted for every avenue of escape, that you had tried everything and were in desperate fear of your own life. They'll never buy your story. Because obviously, you've got a bedroom. You've got a kitchen. You've got other rooms in a house. So don't shoot him in the living room. Now, if he chases you to the bedroom, don't shoot him in the bedroom. Now, he's got a butcher knife, or he's got a gun, too, but you've got a gun. But you can't kill him in a bedroom. Do you know why? Well, because you haven't yet proved that you have done every possible thing you could to escape his presence. So you run from the bedroom to the bathroom. Now, don't kill him in the bathroom, because the bathroom has a shower, and you're not in the shower yet. And you haven't proved that you have taken every possible advantageous escape route left open to you to avoid having to kill this guy in self-defense. So get in the shower. Now if he attacks you, and if the shower doesn't have a window, you might be able to get off, but don't ever shoot him in the back. Don't wound him, and then as he turns to run, shoot him again, because if you shoot him in the back, you're going to go to jail probably for the rest of your natural life. Now, the Bible law says if a thief be found breaking up and he is smitten, I mean somebody has him halfway in the window and whack, a 9-pound sledgehammer, you know, kawham, that's the end of him. Karate chop, two before, right across the bridge of the nose, whatever. Bicycle chain, that'll do it, lead pipe, anything. But here's a crook breaking in your apartment and you hit him over the head and he dies. It says there shall no blood be shed for him. That's it. That's the risk he took. He's trying to rip you off. He got killed in the process. I don't think blood would be shed for him under this law, and I also don't think any tears would be shed for him either. But, of course, we look at it differently today, which is why we are the most crime-ridden nation in all of human history, the most crime-ridden country on the face of the earth, why our cities are the most fearful places on the whole of this great green globe. You can walk with more safety in the city of Jerusalem, I mean the old city on the Arab side, in the old quarter, at night, with your ring, your watch, your wallet, and a cane in your hand if you're 77, with far, far more safety than you can the streets of the nation's capital. You can walk on the streets of Arab cities, Cairo, Damascus, Riyadh, Mecca, Medina, and be safe. You know why? Because some of those countries over there, do you know some of those Arab countries actually believe in this law? They look upon Moses as a great prophet. They actually read some of the Old Testament scriptures. They not only believe in Muhammad, but they believe Abraham, whom they call Ibrahim and so on, was a great prophet. And then look at these laws, and would you believe in some Arab countries they still obey these laws? It says right here, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. They carry it even a little further. In some of those countries, if you steal, the hand that reaches out to steal is severed. It says burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. You know, if we had laws in the United States such as an automatic, mandatory 20-year penalty for the commission of any crime involving a gun, and an automatic death sentence for any crime where injury or death was committed by the use of a gun, you wouldn't believe how the crime statistics would plummet. They would really go down. But when you see even the courts of the land going against the will of the people of the land, I don't know whether there's much hope for that kind of a law to ever be put in or not, but you ought to write for this booklet on Crime Can Be Stopped, Here's How. Crime Can Be Stopped, Here's How is yours free of charge by a telephone call to area 800, and the number is 423-4444. Or you can dial for listeners in Alaska, California, or Hawaii, area 213-577-5225, or write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, for that free booklet. The address again in just a moment. Tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.